Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
That Centene move is remarkable and something that will play into the conversation that we're about to have with not only a member of Congress, but one of the only physicians who's going to be voting on this bill whenever this does happen. Today, tomorrow, we can bring you up to date right now. We're waiting for a vote on a rule here on the House floor, and the potential for a full floor vote could be today, tonight, tomorrow morning, maybe on the 4th of July, as we just discussed with Laura Davison. It appears nobody's going home until this is done, unless, of course, this is really derailed with worries about debt and deficit, with worries about changes, dare I use the word cuts to Medicaid, and a couple of other matters. It does seem the SALT caucus has come around, but there are a lot of questions right now about what this is going to bring to the floor. The members of the Freedom Caucus, the fiscal hawks who oppose this, are meeting at the White House right now. And we're joined in studio by a Republican member of Congress who you've heard from before on this program, who was in fact treating Medicaid patients as recently as yesterday. Greg Murphy from North Carolina. Great to see you and welcome back to Bloomberg.
Thank you.
It's quite a moment that we're in right now, and you have a unique perspective. I like to think that your colleagues are asking for your advice on this. And I want your input on the changes to Medicaid. Before we get that far, does this rule even get to the floor today? What's the state of play?
Well, I think the rule gets to the floor, whether it passes or not, is the real question. Because, you know, we don't pass the rule, basically it is a stop. Mm-hmm. It is not, if the bill doesn't pass, things can be dead. If we don't pass the rule, it brings us a chance to come back and address concerns that maybe different portions of the House caucus made or have. And, you know, things getting directly from the Senate, that's what they wanted, great. But if we have questions about them or real concerns about them, there needs to be a mechanism, I think, to get those addressed. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are.
When it comes to Medicaid, we've talked about this before, and I know that you supported eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse from the program. You've spoken openly about that. There are other changes and potential cuts that you might be worried about. There's also the matter of the provider tax and what it means for rural hospitals. Give us the physician's view here.
Yeah, I think if we back up, this is an exceedingly overly complex system of Medicaid reimbursement where we have, you know, things where the hospitals tax themselves, send the money to the state, and the state then draws down more money to give back to the hospitals. Yeah. You have these direct funds, you have indirect funds. It is a very, very complex scheme, mm-hmm. if it will. And what's been allowed to happen really over the last couple decades, especially the last decade, is a lot of drawdowns from the federal government to do things that states really should be doing on themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, North Carolina just expanded Medicaid a couple years ago, and that brings an entirely new population in. I was in favor of that because those are our working poor, the farmers, the fishermen, the clergy, the people in eastern North Carolina that are working but just simply can't afford health care. You know, we want to attack this, and the House version was waste, fraud, and abuse. Nobody can argue with those things, getting people off the rolls that were illegally on the rolls or illegally in the country or were able-bodied. The Senate has taken a little bit different approach. It's kind of one of those things that it's like, I'll use the basketball analogy. It's not the first foul you see. It's the reaction to the foul. And the first foul we've seen, really a lot happened with the Biden administration of expanding the Medicaid rolls to people that honestly should not be eligible, are not eligible to be on this. So it's trying to now correct that, and we look like we're the bad guys because we're the second person seen as the foul in trying to fix a system and reform a system for those individuals who truly deserve it.
That's quite an analogy. So are you close to a yes, or are you stuck on this right now?
I am in the information gathering stage. You know, I will tell you this, as a surgeon, we always measure twice and cut once. That's just what we do. And usually surgeons are pretty direct and we go through things, but this is too important just for a knee-jerk response. Look, I'm on Trump's team. I want him to succeed, but I also think he wants the best package possible delivered to the American people.
Well, this is interesting because I know that you support Donald Trump.
Sure.
But you also see a window that's not necessarily closing here. We don't have to manage the debt limit, for instance, until we're probably into August.
Yeah.
That gives you a whole other month to work on this, right?
Yeah, you know, but time is of the essence. We do want to get this done now. We don't want to sit there and let this drag out because there are some, truth be told, some political concerns to do this. But we have a chance. We have a moment in time, really, to get this right, stop some of the abuses that are occurring within the Medicaid system. I mean, there are, not only on the individual level, but on hospital levels and other levels. There are abuses that have occurred. I was chief of staff of our, at the time, a $2 billion medical system. And so I know a lot about where the monies come from, where they go. There's a lot of individuals that, there's a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse that goes in these. Yeah. You know, I see, you see some of these CEOs of hospital systems earning millions and millions of dollars when most of the most of their monies are coming in from taxpayer initiatives. There's, I have a problem with some of that. You know, it's one thing for CEOs that run companies on the 500 index or whatever, but it's a different thing when you're making your money based upon taxpayer dollars.
Sure.
That said, there are a lot of abuses that go in this system. There is, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get it right. We need to get it right. You know, one other thing I'll just say is in the state of North Carolina, 52% of the births occur to mothers on Medicaid.
Wow.
So how is this? How, this is a symptom of a societal issue. Mm-hmm. Now we're being paid for with Medicaid dollars. Mm-hmm. And how do we fix that issue, which actually makes then the Medicaid issue much easier to treat? I don't have the answer to that. We have, and I see this all the time, Joe. I see kids coming in having kids, and their grandmother, who's 32, taking care of the child, when the child still is either in high school or trying to figure out if they can go to college or not. That's a systemic issue of society, and we're trying to deal with it, trying to pay for it somehow, which at some point you got to draw the line. We can't keep doing this. We have to have some financial responsibility here.
Is there anyone to tell a story like that to President Trump? I mean, that's an incredible first-hand analysis.
Well, I don't know anybody in Congress that still practices medicine. I'm the only physician that still does. I live in a very, very poor area of eastern North Carolina, which are all Trump supporters. Mm-hmm. And so I do think it is a message he needs to hear, how critical this is going to be for eastern North Carolina. I'm just trying to figure out how to thread this needle, you know, to fulfill the agenda that the president wants, but at the same time to make sure that access is affordable and accessible for the patients I see in eastern North Carolina.
When you consider the process here and the potential for another reaction or another foul, you make enough changes, this has to go back to the Senate. Does that need to happen? Or can you make changes without that happening?
I don't know that if we make changes, I think legislatively it has to go back to the Senate.
Sure.
But, you know, again, you know, you measure twice, you cut once.
Yeah.
Let's do this right. Let's not try to have to say, well, we'll come back and fix that later. I'm not into that kind of stuff.
Otherwise, you feel like you got jammed by the Senate.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I think the Senate's the guys and gals were with great intent on what they wanted to do. I had been told there was a lot more discussions about this beforehand. But I think the Senate really actually did close to 90% of what we wanted. The changes they are were pretty radical changes.
Yeah, boy, that's right. I wanted to ask you about your colleague from North Carolina on the Senate side, Tom Tillis. Pretty remarkable development here.
Yeah.
James, I don't know if we can get that sound of Senator Tillis on the Senate floor over the weekend. Of course, he's decided not to run for re-election based on a pretty tight jam that he was in, and some would argue that he was facing a very difficult primary to begin with. Let's hear from Senator Tillis, if we can, from earlier on this process.
I'm telling the president that you have been misinformed. You supporting the Senate mark will hurt people who are eligible and qualified for Medicaid. We're going to make sure that we fulfill the promise, and then I can feel good about a bill that I'm willing to vote for. But until that time, I will be withholding my vote.
Pretty passionate stuff. I'm sure you've had a chance to talk to the senator. What would you tell him, though? Is he off on this one?
No, I think there are are parts that Senator Tillis is spot on, correct.
Yeah.
But we're in a system that has exploded. You know, the Biden administration, normally state audits their Medicaid rolls every year. Who's eligible? Who's not eligible? The Biden administration didn't want any of that. In fact, the head of CMS had two jobs to do. She was in charge of infusing as much DEI into medicine as possible and trying to put people on Medicaid rolls, honestly, who don't deserve to be there. Mm. Will there be some collateral damage? There's collateral damage with any legislation, Joe, any legislation. But it's my job is to try to make sure that there are agreements, not only from the federal government, but also back in the state legislature. I spoke with the Senator Pro Tem Berger, and I pretty much was very firm that, look, if this comes down the pike, the state's going to have to cough up some other monies that it's been trying to pull down from the federal government now. We cannot bankrupt the federal government on issues that the state should be taking care of.
Well, we see a lawmaker like that call it quits, and we've seen a few, Don Bacon and other. And I realize he may have had his own personal issues in making that decision. But you wonder, you're more effective by staying here in office trying to make changes.
Well, you know, I think Senator Tillis has been thinking about this for a while, and this may just have been the last straw.
Sure, of course. Everyone's got their own story. You're going to run for Senate in North Carolina?
Well, I've been asked. I was on the way over here. I got another text asking I'd consider it. So,
well, this is interesting. Are you allowing yourself a certain period of time to make that decision?
Well, I think, Joe, I did not raise my hand to get into politics a few years ago. I got recruited, and it gives me a little bit of freedom. I can always fall back on being a lowly surgeon full time. And I've said that before. I want to do the right thing. And next week, if we get something done, I think we'll really start to look at this. Who are the players in the game? We can't let a Democrat take this seat. I'm sorry. North Carolina needs a Republican in that seat. And
you wonder what would happen if Roy Cooper became the next senator from North Carolina.
I think that would be problematic. He's been a little too far left and supported things that the Democrat Party right now. Good Lord, if you saw what – you can look and see what happened with the New York mayor's race. Nobody can recognize the Democratic Party anymore.
So
I'll make that decision next week or the week thereafter. And
so you could take a pay cut for a whole other job as a physician. You just stay here in Washington and make less money.
Yeah.
Fascinating. I'd love to stay in touch with you on that and hear about this deliberation, because I know that's not an easy decision to make. Is that something you're talking to your family about?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, just like with all the other decisions, you sit down, you talk with your family, you ask the good Lord for some prayers and guidance, and you either walk through doors that are opened up, or you let somebody else that you think can do the job as well walk through too. I've got great colleagues in North Carolina. We just have to make sure we put somebody that can beat a Democrat and be a great senator.
Measure twice, cut once.
That's exactly right.
That's the takeaway here from Greg Murphy. You're going to head back to the House now.
Yeah.
We'll have our eyes on you, and this is going to be wild. Good luck in the next 24 to 48 hours. We'll see if this bill passes.
Great.
Thanks for talking to us.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
From North Carolina, of course, and speaking on behalf of the Republicans here in Washington, some of whom have not made up their mind. And we could still see some changes to this legislation, as we just heard from Congressman Murphy himself. We'll assemble our panel coming up next. Rick Davis and Jim Messina are with us to hash this out here as we prepare to count the votes on a Wednesday in Washington. We've got a lot more ahead here on the fastest show in politics. Stay with us. I'm Joe Matthew, live from Washington. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We're all watching, of course, the House floor right now with a series of procedural matters that we're going through here that may or may not lead us to a full smash vote on the big, beautiful bill. Thanks for being with us here on the Wednesday edition. Indeed, I'm Joe Matthew in Washington here on Bloomberg Radio, satellite radio channel 121, Bloomberg Originals, and YouTube. Search Bloomberg Business News Live to see our video feed here. A UC storm, they're calling it, taking place on the floor of the House right now as members of the Congressional Black Caucus storm the rostrum with a series of unanimous consent requests, not to necessarily get anything done other than slow the process. Democrats, of course, have been locked out of this process. That is the way it works when you're dealing with reconciliation. It's a Republican family matter. Although Democrats are speaking about it, as we heard from Minority Leader in the House, Hakeem Jeffries, earlier. Listen.
Every single House Democrat will stand up for your health care. Stand up for your Medicaid. Stand up for your Medicare. Stand up for the Affordable Care Act. Stand up for nutritional assistance for our children, our seniors, and our veterans. So all we need are four Republicans to join us in support of their constituents, to have John McCain level courage and stand up in defense of the health care of the American people.
Haven't we come a long way when the Democratic leader in the House is referring to John McCain to get a round of applause from other Democrats. Let's assemble our political panel. Speaking of John McCain, Bloomberg Politics contributor Rick Davis is with us, Republican strategist and partner at Stone Court Capital. I'm also happy to say Jim Messina's back. Democratic strategist, of course, ran Barack Obama's 2012 campaign. Gentlemen, great to see you both, and welcome to the conversation. Rick, I don't know if your ears were ringing there, but we just had a conversation with a Republican member of the House, Greg Murphy, from North Carolina, the last, I believe, or only serving physician in the House of Representatives. He's a Trump supporter. He's a MAGA guy. And even he has deep concerns about the changes that are being made to Medicaid, the impact it could have on his state. He's still not a yes. How far are we away from this actually potentially passing?
Yeah, I only wish we had a few of those Democrats that thought John McCain was a hero at the time we were voting for him for president back in 2008 when Jim Messina and his team kicked my butt. Look, I mean, this is a pretty unpopular bill in America. Most polls I've seen really significantly net negative. I think that the White House and the Republican majority have done an average job at best selling it to the American public. Obviously, they've been consumed with selling it to each other, and that takes up a lot of time. But they're really going to have a job to do. If this thing gets signed into law, they're going to have to hit the road and sell this hard. Otherwise, they're going to get the wrath of the American electorate come midterms. But look, I think that, the Congressman Murphy, he's looking at running for the Senate potentially. He made no bones about that in a conversation with you just now. That's a news item. The reality is anybody who's going to be on a ballot in 2026 is trying to figure out how do you go back and sell this to the constituents that put you into office. And I think a lot of these guys are starting to worry about that today.
Really interesting. Yeah, I have to admit, I was struck by Congressman Murphy's answers. It does sound like he's really considering a run for Senate. Jim Messina, I can't imagine what's going through your head right now. Democrats don't play a role in this, but they're going to have a lot to say on the midterm trail, as Rick just mentioned. Are you making commercials already?
Boy, they'd be pretty easy to make, Joe. I agree with Rick. I mean, this bill is about as popular as garbage. Like, it is, when you look at the numbers, 78% of Americans want no cuts to Medicaid. This cuts Medicaid almost $1 trillion. And more importantly, for a bunch of people who are Bloomberg regular watchers, I don't think anyone on this line or watching thinks that adding another $4 trillion to the debt is a great idea. I think defending this next year in the ballot box is going to be a nightmare for Republicans. And, it's like Groundhog Day. We've been through this. In 2018, Donald Trump and the Republicans lost the House because the American public thought they were going after Obamacare and going after health care. So then fast forward, we're going to do the same thing again when they're making cuts to Obamacare, they're making cuts to Medicaid, they're making cuts to Medicare, and they think it'll be a different response. And I just think that it is very, very unclear that the American public is going to sit back and say this is a great idea.
Well, while we're talking about the messaging component here, interesting poll, Rick, that came from Tony Fabrizio, Donald Trump, as they say, preferred pollster. He ran numbers in Georgia, Maine, Michigan, and the aforementioned North Carolina, and talked about this bill as rebranding it essentially as the Working Families Tax Cuts Bill. Poll found respondents came back 62% favorable, 12% unfavorable when it was given that title, that framing. And measures taken individually, like child tax credit, no taxes on tips, no taxes on overtime, were overwhelmingly popular. Can Republicans thread the needle on this and talk about the individual components as opposed to, well, the big, beautiful bill? Or you've seen this movie before, and it's pretty difficult to delineate to the voter.
Yeah, look, I mean, the problem with doing this segmentation act, right, taking little, pieces of the whole and saying, oh, look, you should be happy with this because it has this in it. I mean, this is a 1,000-page bill with, trillions of dollars at stake. And when you boil it down, if you're a family that has now become at risk with its Medicaid in those states, it doesn't matter what the politicians are telling you. If your Medicaid gets cut, if your local rural hospital shuts down, these are the things that matter to voters. Voters don't care about the rhetoric. They care about the impact on them. If they don't see a tangible plus in their pocketbooks between now and November of 26. They're going to vote their pocketbook. And it's an awful hard sell to try and tell people, don't believe what's happening in your kitchen table. Believe what we're telling you happened in Washington. I go with the kitchen table every time.
An even larger majority, really interesting here, Jim Messina, agree that able-bodied adults should have some sort of work requirements. When it comes to the Medicaid cuts, two-thirds of voters agree there is waste, fraud, and abuse. How do you message against that?
Well, you message again. Well, it's true, right? There is waste, fraud, and abuse, and getting rid of some of that, as Congressman Murphy talked about, the American public's supportive. But they're not going to look at that. Voters are going to look exactly like Rick just said, and they're going to say, what does this do to me? Voters want to know what it does to me. And there's no question they're going to get less Medicaid next year. There's no question they're going to get less Medicare. And their Obamacare tax credits, which everyone files at the end of the year, are going to be substantially reduced. And that's what they're going to look at. They're just not, you know, you can't say, look at this shiny penny over here and think voters are going to fall for it. They're going to look at what's in it for them. And what's in it for them is going to be a very difficult thing to defend. And I'm not being partisan about this. Rick's exactly right. I had to try to defend Obamacare in 2010 after we passed 1,000-page changes to the ACA, and it was impossible. It was so difficult, and we lost 70 seats in the House. And this is likely what the Republicans are going to have to try to do in the midterm elections, and I think it's a tall order.
Wow. Rick, Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall just caught up with Congressman Andy Harris, who chairs the House Freedom Caucus on Capitol Hill. We'll try to get this sound a little bit later in the broadcast. Asked if he's negotiating with the White House, knowing that there were members of the Freedom Caucus at the White House, I believe they're still there right now, talking to the president. Whether you're deal-making over potential EOs, commitments to legislation down the line, Andy Harris said on camera, Rick, I have not been talking to the White House about it. This is a decision to be made inside the House, and it will be handled inside the House today. What does that tell you about the state of affairs? Do we get a rule vote today, or is this thing going off the rails?
Well, he sounds a little spunky this morning. No telling what he had to leave at home to get to Washington and do this work. But look, I mean, you know, anybody who's been betting against Speaker Johnson and Donald Trump, our deputy speaker of the House of Representatives, has been wrong 100% of the time this year, right? And there is a magic in the White House when you get these guys sitting in the Oval Office with the President of the United States, regardless of who he is, you're going to get your way 90% of the time. My guess is he gets his way, and those guys who are there are going to sit down with Andy and say, oh my God, you are making our lives intolerable. Would you just not do any interviews between now and the rules votes, you know, we've got today? Because look, I mean, it's every man for himself in the House always. But Johnson has been cagey about getting his caucus to vote the right way. And I have no doubt Donald Trump has got thumbscrews working overtime today in the Oval Office.
Yeah. Thumbscrews. Yeah, he's got no public events scheduled, and we haven't seen an update on the guidance, certainly as of yet. Fascinating reporting by NBC News, Jim Messina. You spent enough time in the Oval to know how things operate inside the West Wing. And Donald Trump has a very different brand. He calls the Oval Office his nickname for the Oval Office. I'll have to find this. It's basically Grand Central. And off of Grand Central, where you have lots of people milling in and out, apparently, there's something he calls the Monica Lewinsky Room, the space near the Oval Office. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you can Google it, where he keeps a beautifully organized gift shop of MAGA hats, T-shirts, and the rest. A Republican senator who was invited for a bill signing described this. J.D. Vance standing outside the Oval drinking coffee, eating cookies. Does this sound like somebody who cares about the details of this bill or just wants it passed?
I think he just wants it passed, and that's not a criticism of him. Like, he views himself as the kind of orchestrator and the leader and someone who wants this thing done. And he's smart enough, to Rick's point, to say, look, the speaker knows how to get votes. The speaker hasn't failed. you know, the speaker will let me know who I need to put the thumb screws to, and we'll go get this done. And eventually what's going to happen here, I think this bill is going to pass this week, because they're going to have some version of Rick or I, the political hack, walk into the caucus and say, do you guys really want to go home and have the entire country lobbying you on this bill and start to figure out what's in this bill? You want to go home to your districts and have to defend some of the stuff in this? No, you do not. So let's pass this and go home and keep low and start to try to sell it. And I think that's probably what Donald Trump's version of this is. He's been calling members saying, I will primary you if you don't vote for this. And then Johnson's going to hand out every piece of candy he can to get people to vote for it. If you need a water project in your district, today's a pretty great time to ask, Joe.
Grand Central Terminal is how he described the Oval. Rick Davis, what do you think it's like in there right now?
Oh, I'm sure there's all kinds of interesting discussions going on. Jim Messina just mentioned the approach that hacks like us take. You know, it's a combination of cajoling and special offers. The really good cufflinks come out of the box today and get shuffled around. But at the other end of the equation, there are people out there showing polls right now that shows vulnerable incumbent House members who might get introduced to their MAGA primary opponent this afternoon. You know, it goes both ways. Just depends upon what they think is going to need to get a vote. And I agree. I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen, you know, either on or before 4th of July. The president's going to get his way. I would not vote. I would not bank against him, you know, with this caucus.
All right. I just needed to hear Rick Davis say it. Absolutely great. As Ryan notes, what a line here. You want to go home and find out what's in the bill and have to defend it? This is the world we're in right now with Jim Messina and Rick Davis. Many thanks to you both. Stay with us on the fastest show in politics. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Voting is starting. Not yet voting on the rule that, of course, is the key procedural hurdle that needs to be conquered in order for the House to get to a vote on final passage of the bill, the reconciliation bill that the Senate passed yesterday. We have a multi-vote series about to go down. Joe, the third vote will be on this rule, and there is no guarantee that the rule itself can pass, as House Freedom Caucus members are suggesting they will not support it. And of course, you just spoke in the last hour with Congressman Greg Murphy, who suggested that this thing very well could go down.
Yeah, he thought the rule may well fail, and this whole process could move into next week. The only serving physician in the House of Representatives, Greg Murphy, was very concerned about the changes being made to Medicaid. He was asking to slow the process down and, in fact, make changes to this bill specifically to Medicaid, which would require it going back to the Senate, Kaylee. And I'm not sure anyone has the wherewithal for that.
Well, it certainly would make that July 4th deadline the president wants to meet very difficult to meet if you have to take this to conference. But even some senators were calling for that yesterday, like Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who ultimately voted to pass it in the Senate, says she hoped the House would change it and send it back to her chamber.
We've heard that from a couple of folks here on the Senate side. It's unclear exactly how this is going to play out today. But as Kaylee mentioned, we are anticipating at least a rules vote. And so let's bring you to the House right now. Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall has been up there all morning and has the latest for us. Tyler, what are you hearing?
Yeah, hey, Joe. So we are still waiting for this vote to happen. Of course, it's a procedural vote, this vote on the rule, but it is important to ultimately paving the way for final passage because they can't vote on the final contents of the bill until this rule is passed. And it's going to give us an indication here in the following moments how difficult House Speaker Mike Johnson's job is about to get, because if the rule fails, that could have a whole bunch of different implications for how they need to negotiate this package to get it over the finish line. Now, we've been talking about how there's pretty broad agreement about the core pillars of this package when it comes to the tax cut side of things, but it is those spending cuts and how this bill will add to our national debt that is really starting to spur some of the most vocal critics of the bill here on Capitol Hill. That includes those members of the House Freedom Caucus, such as Congressman Chip Roy, a Republican from Texas. I actually had the chance to catch up with him earlier today. He predicted that this first vote on the rule will fail and suggested that the Senate might need to come back into town so they can talk about this legislation.
We sent them a product. We liked it in some respects. Could be better in others. The Senate has now made some changes. Some are good. Some are bad. Now we got to look at the total product and decide what is bad. It's not take it or leave it. I don't even take it or leave it legislating. How about we send it back to them and we say take it or leave it, right? So the Senate doesn't get to be the final say on everything. Got to work this out.
So Joe and Kaylee, we're going to have to see how this ultimately develops, whether or not there actually is an appetite for the Senate to retake this up, considering when we think about how these fiscal hawks counterparts in the Senate, like Ron Johnson and Rick Scott, ultimately ended voting in favor of this bill. Now, I also caught up with the House Freedom Caucus Chair Andy Harris. He told me that he's actually not talking to the White House about this. When I asked if there's any sort of negotiations going on for some sort of other deal, such as promises for legislation down the line or executive orders, say, to boost revenue raisers or curb spending that they could maybe get on board with. And he said that they're not discussing it. Instead, they are focused on changing the priorities in this package. Two main ones I'll leave you with. One is snapping back the phase out of the clean energy tax credits to how the House originally had them. That would be 2027. The House has a more lenient timeline. But second, something that struck me as really interesting, he wants to see some of the business tax credits made temporary again. The Senate had made most of them permanent. So we're going to have to see if potentially there could be any sort of wiggle room there. Because as you both well know, this bill is not designed to ping pong between the chambers.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. Tyler, when we consider this vote on the rule, yes, it going down would certainly complicate measures and kill the floor effort for now. But we have seen with votes in the past when the speaker has struggled to get his whip count essentially where it needs to be, he just has left the vote open and allowed President Trump himself time to make phone calls to the holdouts. Is it possible that we could see that this afternoon?
Potentially, we'll have to see. We won't get too wonky into the procedure here, but Republicans are going to need to do a little bit of shifting in how the bill was actually written, because it does appear that they actually left out a procedural move that would have opened up that possibility to keep the debate open, give House Speaker Mike Johnson essentially an exit plan if everything goes to turmoil once it does get to the floor. We are expecting that to be, though, an option on the table for him moving forward here. We know that President Trump is already calling up these members, inviting them to the White House. It was interesting to hear. It's our understanding that some of those more fiscal conservatives were over at the White House, but also Congressman Mike Lawler, Republican from New York, somebody who helped negotiate that SALT deal that we thought was happy and on board with it, which does bring us to another group to keep our eye on, not necessarily the SALT Republicans, but also those moderate Republicans in those critical battleground districts who have raised concerns about changes to Medicaid, not necessarily tightening the work requirements, Joe and Kaylee, but how the Senate plan lowers that Medicaid provider tax for states that expanded coverage under the Affordable Care Act. That could also prove problematic when it comes to dissent going forward, since we know 16 Republicans had vowed that they wouldn't vote for this if the bill did lower that provider tax.
All right, Tyler Kendall, reporting live from Capitol Hill for us on Bloomberg TV and radio. Thank you so much. And we want to stay live on Capitol Hill as we turn now to Democratic Congresswoman Susan DelBene of Washington, who, of course, chairs the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. She is charged with making sure Democrats get elected to the House of Representatives. Congresswoman, welcome back to Balance of Power. It's always great to have you. When we consider that there are some of your Republican colleagues who are holding out on this legislation for now, they'd like to see it changed in ways that could mean more rollbacks of, or quicker rollbacks of, Inflation Reduction Act subsidies, perhaps deeper spending cuts elsewhere. At this point, is it actually the best case scenario for Democrats and the American public if this bill passes as is, because it could only get worse from your perspective if it's further changed?
Well, let's be clear. This is a terrible bill. It raises costs for American families. It guts health care. 17 million people across the country losing their health care coverage. Prices going up for everyone else. This is a terrible bill, and we are united in being against this bill. And frankly, more Republicans should be against this bill, because the American people are against this bill. Poll after poll, the more people learn about this bill, the more they dislike it. And it is fiscally irresponsible. Republicans who want to make it worse, they've all voted for this once in the House. They have the chance to decide what they're going to do going forward. This is a terrible bill, and it's going to hurt all of their districts and their communities. So hopefully there will be some Republicans who are willing to actually stand up for the American people and vote against this bill. But we know they all cave whenever it comes down to it and follow along with Donald Trump.
So you're not expecting these no's to stay knows, apparently, Congresswoman. I'm just wondering, and I know there's not a lot of conversation across the aisle, if any, right now, but are you reaching out to Republicans who are on the fence or prepared to vote no to join your coalition against this legislation?
We welcome any Republicans who are going to vote no. They should be voting no, because the impacts of this are devastating, long-term impacts to our communities. And in Republican districts, thousands and thousands of people losing access to health care, losing access to basic nutrition support, making sure that we have healthy foods for our kids, energy costs going up, the list goes on, and just, you know, $4 trillion increase to the debt, that impacts our kids too. So Republicans say they're fiscally responsible, absolutely not. In this case, if they want to do something different, they should stand up, vote no, and come to the table and actually work on a policy that will help move our country forward, invest in our future, invest in working families.
Well, Congresswoman, obviously it is your charge at the DCCC to be looking at the map. And if you look at it district by district and how the impact of this legislation may ultimately be felt in districts with seats currently held by Republicans, how many potential pickup opportunities do you see as a result?
Well, I think this bill, it really defines where Republicans are, and this bill and their vote on this bill is going to be a huge reason we take back the majority in the House of Representatives. The American people reject the bill, but in district after district, we have 35 districts where we're on offense across the country. In those 35 districts, people in these communities will lose health care, see health care costs go up, see energy costs go up, see food prices go up. Republicans promised they were going to lower costs on day one. It's the number one issue for families across the country. They promised they were going to lower costs. That's a broken promise. This big, ugly bill is also a big, broken promise. So we're gonna hold them accountable for that across the country.
Is that potentially 35 seats then, Congresswoman? Do you think it could be that many?
We have 35 seats we're in play across the country. We're recruiting great candidates. Folks are going to actually stand up for their communities, who are going to really be voices for their communities, talk about the issues that matter, and who actually want to come to Washington, D.C. to govern for communities, not be a blindly loyal vote for Donald Trump.
You've mentioned the number of people who could potentially lose health coverage, and I think 17 million is the number that we've been hearing, Congresswoman, that you mentioned as well. There's a new survey from Tony Fabrizio's group, commissioned by One Nation, that found two-thirds of voters agree there is waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicaid. How do you message to them?
We know that families across the country depend on Medicaid. Our rural hospitals depend on Medicaid. Look across the board. This has nothing to do with strengthening Medicaid. What Republicans are trying to do is rip it apart, $1 trillion, rip it apart, rip apart the Affordable Care Act subsidies that are out there. 17 million people losing health care, but also rural hospitals closing across the country, nursing homes. All of these are things that are supported through Medicaid that are critically important to all of our communities. So healthcare costs will go up for everyone in the country, because even if you have coverage, premiums are going to go up when more and more people are using the emergency room as their primary care. We've seen before how damaging that is. They're walking us down that path again now, and the American people know that.
Congresswoman, I know you need to run back to the floor, so very quickly here, Elon Musk this week has threatened to fund primary challenges of Republicans who vote for this bill, but also has threatened to start a new Third America Party. Does Elon Musk pose a potential gift for Democrats if he's going to fund challengers to Republicans, or potentially a risk if he actually wants to fund a third party?
Well, I think Elon Musk called this bill a disgusting abomination. That's an apt description. We all should be fighting to prevent this bill from moving forward. But making sure we have great representatives across the country, the American people are with us on this. We're on offense, and this vote is going to cost Republicans the majority in 2026.
Congresswoman, it's great to have you back. She is chairwoman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Susan DelBene of Washington. remarkable to hear her weigh in on this, Kaylee, as we try to get a sense of what Democrats want to do, likely in the aftermath of this vote, knowing that they can't impact this legislation in the meantime. I want to bring in Rick Davis, Bloomberg Politics contributor and Republican strategist, for his view on this. Rick, is Susan DelBene correct? Do Democrats win the midterms because of this bill?
You know, the midterms are usually bad for the party in power anyway, regardless of what kind of legislation was passed. But earlier in this program, we heard from Jim Messina talking about 2010, the cycle after they passed ACA, and it was very controversial at the time, very similar to this bill in some respects. And they lost 53 seats. That was the largest gain by Republicans since the 1930s. And so if you start looking at parallels, it could be a really horrific year for Republicans if it looks like 2010 reincarnated.
Does that apply to the Senate as well, Rick? Where at the very least, we know North Carolina may be more of a live question now that Tom Tillis has decided he's not seeking reelection.
Yeah, the Senate has been able to avoid the sort of party in power losses that have been historic for the House of Representatives. That being said, as you point out, Kaylee, I mean, like, this is an interesting year because we have some retirements and some close seats that could actually make a bad year look even worse in the United States Senate. So I think nobody's taking anything for granted right now in the United States Senate. But there are seats like in Texas and in North Carolina, and certainly Susan Collins perennially is at risk in Maine. These are seats that are going to have to be really, really harshly defended. But the key is that the Republicans step out from this week when they do pass this bill and sign it into law and actually try to sell it in a way that, as Tony Fabrizio pointed out, there are things that people like in this bill, but they got to sell it.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We talk politics in Washington with a lot of question marks over the Capitol right now, and I suspect over the White House as well, with members of the House Freedom Caucus meeting today with President Trump, and a series of procedural votes that are underway right now in the House. They are preparing to vote, Republicans hoping to vote, on the floor on President Trump's big, beautiful bill that's coming back from the Senate. But there are changes to this bill, Kaylee, that a lot of members of the Republican conference are uncomfortable with. It's kind of like we're just relitigating this entire debate, remembering that the moderates were concerned about spending cuts to Medicaid, House Freedom Caucus wanting to see lower debt and deficits, lower spending. These are the same lawmakers who are hashing this out for a second time.
Yeah, knowing they barely sorted out their differences the first time when it passed the House initially, it was on a margin of a single vote.
A squeaker.
And then it went back to the Senate, it changed, and now the House Freedom Caucus especially is not super willing to just take what the Senate gave them and give it a thumbs up. That's what we're hearing from the likes of Congressman Chip Roy, who has suggested that it shouldn't be take it or leave it, that the House could change it until the Senate take it or leave it.
Well, and then we remind ourselves this is a self-imposed July 4 deadline. We spoke earlier with Congressman Greg Murphy, who saw no problem in letting this go another week or so that would allow for changes to be made, it to go back to the Senate, schoolhouse rock. Eventually the president signs the bill.
So let's get the latest read now from inside the Republican conference and turn to Congressman Jim Jordan, the Republican from Ohio and also chair of the House Judiciary Committee, is live with us on Bloomberg TV and radio. Congressman, thank you so much for your time, knowing you're going to be running to the floor shortly to continue these votes. But as you see it right now, does the rule have the votes to pass?
No.
And it sounds like we're still working on that connection. But if you've asked, we've asked this question to a number of lawmakers, as have our colleagues on the Hill today, and at least many of them are suggesting that no, the answer
the rule
is
may
at
not
this
pass.
Time, they do not.
In that world, it could go back to the Rules Committee, which could be another fraught conversation. They went for hours arguing about this yesterday, Kaylee, and late into the night. Whether this can get to the floor otherwise remains a question. We also don't know if he has the votes. If you can't pass the rule, you might not be able to pass the bill. So these procedural votes tell us a lot more about what could happen with a final product. If that's the case, it's hard to imagine that lawmakers get home, though. Leadership has been clear. The president's been clear. You're working through the holiday.
Well, and the president probably reiterated that once again when he met with members of Congress and the House Freedom Caucus, specifically at the White House.
Yeah.
The head honcho has gotten involved. The question is his arm twisting actually adequate to get these current holdouts in line? So I believe we have our connection established with Congressman Jim Jordan now. Again, Republican from Ohio, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, here with us on Balance of Power. Congressman, is this rule vote about to fail shortly?
Yeah, I hope it passes. We've got the rule vote coming up, and I hope it passes. I think it will, and frankly, I think it should, because this is a good piece of legislation. I always say, you know, it's a good piece of legislation because the Democrats hate it so much. They don't like it because it actually empowers families by, you know, letting them keep more of their money, giving them school choice, making sure our border stays secure, and making able-bodied people in our welfare system now have to work if they're going to get your tax dollar. So I think it just, I think it's a good bill, and I hope it passes.
I know that Congressman, obviously Democrats tell us that they hate the bill and they've not been part of this process, but what is your message to Republicans who are on the fence? We spoke earlier with Congressman Greg Murphy, for instance. He's really worried about changes to Medicaid having a detrimental impact on some low-income people in his district in North Carolina. There are others like him. This needs to be worked out in the family. What do you tell your colleague from North Carolina in a moment like this?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was a 50-50 vote in the Senate. The vice president had to come break the tie. I don't know how many other changes we can make with that kind of a balance. It seems to me we're there, and it's time to pass this legislation. The other thing I know is politics is a lot like athletics, a lot like sport. Momentum matters. And right now, all the momentum is on our side. I mean, we've got a secure border that's taken place under President Trump's leadership. We had the successful operation in Iran. President goes to the NATO summit and gets all the NATO countries to ante up more money, 5% for our defense over there. I mean, we're on a good roll, and now we're gonna stop this bill with such a small majority in both the House and the Senate. Seems to me it's now time to pass it, particularly as I pointed out, because it does the things that actually empower families. I think it's a good bill. Let's get it done. Let's move on to the next item.
Well, President Trump certainly would like to see this done. He would like to see it done in the next few days. Congressman, do you see anything that the president could promise your colleagues who are not yet hard yeses on this bill that could assuage them aside from changing the legislation itself?
I think you just point out what I just talked about. Talk about how good the bill is. The key things in it. I mean, again, if
but
we
I
don't
mean promising
pass this,
pursuing another reconciliation package or executive orders to address some of their concerns.
All that's fine, and we can get to that in the future. But I think you focus on what's in this. Any one single item in this bill, if you pulled it out and voted as a standalone bill, you'd vote for it. I mean, are we for cutting taxes, making sure taxes don't go up on the families we represent? Yes. Are you for saying no tax on tips? We campaigned on that. Yes, we're for that. Does it make sense for people who are able-bodied, who are getting your tax money in our welfare system? Does it make sense that they now have to work? There's a work requirement for able-bodied people. Yes, that makes sense. Standalone, you would vote for that. All these items. Would you vote for additional resources to make sure our borders stay secure after what we went through under Joe Biden? Of course you'd vote for that. So, but you put them all together in some big bill, and some people are like, well, we didn't cut enough spending. I agree, but it's still a good piece of legislation with all those things in it. I think you vote for it because it's consistent with what we told the voters we were going to do when they put us in office on November 5th.
I have to admit, Congressman, I still find it hard to believe that many Republicans are going to vote no and have a tax hike hanging around their necks when they go to run for re-election. I guess to your point, we heard from the former Speaker of the House. Kevin McCarthy was with us this morning on Bloomberg Surveillance, speaking specifically to the holdouts on the Freedom Caucus. And you know who I'm talking about, the Chip Roys, Ralph Normans of the world, who say that they are a no and they want to send the bill back to the Senate with more changes. Here's what he told us.
What they want to do is get the attention they always crave, so they talk about that now. But how many times can you cry wolf and say you're not going to vote for something and in 24 hours vote for it? They have done this numerous times. They want the president's attention. They say this so they can go down to the Oval Office and see the president and go back home and say they saw the president.
Is that how you see this, Congressman? Everybody's a big shot until it's time to actually vote on the floor?
No, I mean, I think they have genuine concerns. I just think, as I pointed out, this is overall a good piece of legislation and we should support it. It is. I always say we make the job way too complicated. The job's pretty simple. What'd you tell the voters you were going to do when you put your name on the ballot and you got elected? go do what you told them you were going to do. And we said, we're going to make sure your taxes don't go up. We're for work requirements. We're for all those things that are in this legislation. So they want additional cuts. I get it. We got huge deficits we're running on an annual basis. We've now piled up $37 trillion in debt. That's a problem. I get that. I wish we could cut more. But we got a handful of seats that that give us the majority in the House. They got a 3-seat majority in the Senate. It's as tight as it gets. So you have to kind of figure out how we get the votes, moderates and conservatives working together. I think we've done that. And by the fact that it was 50-50 in the Senate, I just feel like, okay, there's no more wiggle room. It was 50-50. We're going to have to pass this thing and then look for other opportunities down the road to do some additional things relative to the deficits and the debt.
Well, sir, as we just heard from former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, we remember how his speakership ended, and it was with his own conference upset about some of his choices around fiscal matters. Do you see any risk to Mike Johnson's job as a result of what happens in the coming days?
No, I think the focus is on doing what we told the voters we were going to do. I think what happened to Kevin was wrong, but I don't see any concern with Speaker Johnson. I think Mike has done a good job and navigated through this as best as anyone could with, again, a small majority in the House and a small majority in the Senate. But it's time to pass it, in my judgment, and I hope it happens today.
Well, we do understand where you are, and I wonder how likely that is to happen. Congressman, just give us the state of play. We've got a couple procedural votes here. You need to pass a rule.
Yeah.
Do you think this gets to the floor tonight? Are you going to find yourself here cooking hamburgers and hot dogs on the 4th of July getting ready to vote?
We're going to know, in the next hour. The rule vote's the key vote. If we can pass the rule vote, then I think we're going to pass it on the floor. If we don't pass the rule vote, then, you know, we'll have to see. But I got to head to the floor right now and vote for previous question. Then there's an amendment, and then there's the rule vote. So we got three votes that are happening on the floor now. I got to head to the floor and vote. But if we get past the rule, I think we're going to be fine.
Okay.
And we'll let you, Mr. Chairman, go to the floor and vote. Just one more question for you. As the head of the FHFA, Bill Pulte, today suggested that Congress should investigate the chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, in part for what he said was recent testimony to the Senate about the central bank's planned renovations to its headquarters. Do you intend to open such an investigation?
Everything's on the table. We haven't discussed that specifically. We'll take a look at that. Part of our constitutional duty is to do oversight of the executive branch and our committee. We do oversight of the judicial branch as well. So we'll take a look at all that. That oversight's an important part of our, again, constitutional responsibility as members of the United States Congress.
Well, don't let us make you late for work, Congressman. Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio. He chairs the House Judiciary Committee, now headed back to the floor to take part in the procedural votes that will lead to the rule vote. This is going to be the big one, Kaylee, as Jim Jordan just mentioned. That's going to give us a good sense of where we stand here, likely in the next hour or so, with a floor vote for the so-called Big Beautiful Bill to follow. That could presumably happen tonight, tomorrow, and I guess theoretically on the 4th of July, unless they're going to be here for the weekend. We'll find out. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.